take his mask and shut. I ain't wearing it no more. Y'all look at me like I'm from Mars when I don't wear it in the store. Don't even try to make me put it on or I'm walking out the door. Take his mask and shut. I ain't wearing it no more. I've been shopping in this place for almost 15 years. And I've seen all kinds of viruses, but I've never lived in fear. Now I know that Corona's real and it probably ain't a lot to ask. But I ain't a bank robber and I ain't the Lone Ranger and I don't want to wear this mask. Take this mask and shove it. I ain't wearing it no more. Y'all look at me like I'm the devil when I don't wear it in the store. Don't even try to make me put it on or I'm walking out the door. Take his mask and shove it. I ain't wearing it no more. COVID-19's a real bad dude and they say there ain't no cure. Hydroxychloroquine or a new vaccine, I just can't be sure. Think I'll drink a little shine every morning when I start my day. Might not kill the virus, but it'll give me the courage to say, take this mask and shove it. Corona needs to be gone. My woman stays home, spends all my money on Amazon. I just want to hug everybody like I did before. So take this plague and shove it. We ain't taking it no more. And take this mask and shove it. No, honey, I got it right here. I told you I was going to put it on. It's right here. I'm wearing it. I ain't going without it.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Armchair Survivalist. Today is August 1st in the year 2021, and I thought the opening song was appropriate because of what our ruling communists are going to try and pull on us within the next 3 months. You know, mandatory masks, mandatory this. No matter how much this whole phony plandemic has been invalidated, but with proof, with medical proof, they're still going to keep pushing it, and I'll talk about that later. Anyway, welcome to the show. This is the Armchair Survivalist. All right, now, you go to armchairsurvivalist.com, and you can scroll down at the bottom. You can see all the different ways to listen to me. I'm not going to go through them, because you either know how to listen to me or you don't know how to listen to me. And if you don't know how to listen to me, you're, well, obviously not listening to me. Anyway, so there's all these different ways to listen to me. Every podcast known to man I'm on there, that venue. I also have archives. You can go in and download the show and listen it later at your leisure. Now let's get some business out of the way. The colloidal mineral sales is now over. Just to let everybody know, our prices are going to be going up. Everything that we sell at Survival Enterprises, we haven't raised prices in 20 years, so I'm tired of eating it. We're having to raise prices. Prices are being raised to us. Product is getting hard to find, all kinds, and it's not just through us. It's other companies out there, Home Depot, Lowe's, Costco, the food, Super One Foods, Fred Meyer's, Kroger. It's getting a little difficult to get certain items. And it's like, you know, can't get this item, but you can get these items. But you can't get these two, but you can get this one. So as I've been saying for way too damn long, if you want something, you better damn well go and get it now. Not think about it. This is the unique thing about this universe. Whether you believe in God or not is irrelevant. Let's just say some super entity taps you on the brain and says, you know, it'd be a good idea if you filled the car up with gas. And you go, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I'll get around to it. Well, and you do get around to it in like 3 days. Gas station's out of gas. Now, that's not happening everywhere. But I have seen videos from all over the United States of signs out of gas, out of gas, out of gas. The last time I saw that was, I think it was 1978? And I was in Portland, Oregon. OPEC was embargoing gas from coming into the United States to teach us a lesson. And there were signs everywhere, out of gas, out of gas, out of gas. Anyway, Survival Enterprises, SE1.US, SurvivalEnterprises.com. Go there, see what I have for sale. If you go to ArmchairSurvivalist.com, you will see an ad on the right-hand side, a banner. It says VPN, Virtual Private Network. I'm going to tell you again, everybody should have one. You should have this. It's basically an access point to the internet. You go through it, and now you're anonymous. Now you're protected from prying eyes. And now if you want to see, let's say you want to find out, how do I take this gizmo and make a nasty gizmo? Well, if you look that up on Google without a VPN, then you just raised a bunch of red flags. If you use a VPN, you might raise some red flags, but they won't know who the hell you are or where you are. So think about that. I'll have more data later. Mountain House Foods. These are the this is the horse's mouth. This is the company that invented freeze drying, and their foods are in pouches that will last, and I'm not exaggerating, 40 to 50 years. As long as you keep them safe and secure and not in your garage where it gets 160 degrees. We have Mountain House Foods. It's about a week supply of food. They're different pouches. Okay, there's 15 pouches. There's 2 servings per pouch in a bucket, in one of them square buckets. So it's easy for us to ship. $150 delivered anywhere in the United States. It's on the website. You can find it. I don't know. You can find it. If you're interested, you can find it. If you're not interested in going on our internet, or you can't do that, just give us a call. 800-753-1981. 800-753-1981. I have radios in, and I'm telling you, any of you out there who are interested in being able to communicate when the Schumer hits the fan, or even now, you need a ham radio. They are hard to find. I know you've heard all about how chip shortages are affecting cars. Well, it's not just cars that's being affected. It's everything. All electronics. I am having a hard time getting ham radios in. The ham radios I like to sell are the little handheld ones that come out of China. They're Baofeng or Tenway. You can find them used, onesies one at a time sometimes, but I got to buy like a 12 at a time. So I got some in. I've got maybe 3 left. I found 18 that theoretically will be here in a week and a half, 2 weeks. But these things come and go fast. So I have ham radios. They're $50 to $75, depending on a unit. I also have shortwave radios. Shortwave is the means of listening worldwide to broadcasts that governments can't control. They can block them, but they can't control them. They can't cancel them. They can't turn them off. That's what shortwave is for. And we have an AM/FM shortwave with a NOAA emergency weather band on it. Crank power, solar power, built-in battery power. It's got all the bells and whistles. You can find it on our website. You can call us, and we'll take your order for that. All right, now we've got to get into the economy. And as I've been talking about, the availability of things is becoming extremely problematic. Extremely. The shipping crisis, it's not going away anytime soon. And when I say shipping crisis, I have somebody who lives in Southern California near Long Beach, and he goes out to the port there. If you've never been to the Long Beach port, it will blow your mind. It has the ability to unload, 500 giant ships at a time? This place is massive. It's massive. It's cool. I've been out there. So the container ships come in there, and they're unloaded by longshoremen. And there's a shortage of workers there now. People don't want to work. Why would they work if they're getting unemployment 25 to 50% more than their normal salary? So there are almost 50 container ships today sitting out in the ocean waiting. They're in line waiting to be unloaded. This is not just here. This is everywhere in the world. This is one of the problems. And then once they're unloaded, there's a shortage of truck drivers to deliver these products to warehouses. So this is a big domino effect, and it's 100% planned. I've even posted the Rockefeller Foundation where they said, okay, this is how we can gain control of the world. You do this, 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 and this, and boom, we got control of the world. All right, now we got to get into food and health. Everybody has seen recalls on TV or heard about them on the radio and stuff like that. I get briefings on a daily basis from the Department of Homeland Security, the EPA, the FDA, the CDC, all the other alphabet soup agencies. So we get recalls all the time. And here's the problem. Americans have become very stupid. I mean very stupid. I don't mean ignorant. I mean stupid. And it's taken about 100 years. So when you're stupid, you do stupid things that, well, can harm you or those around you. One of the nastiest stupid things that Americans are doing is not washing their food. They don't wash the produce. They'll buy a bag of apples at the store and put them in the refrigerator and just reach right in and grab one and eat it. Or tomatoes, or carrots, or lettuce, or celery. And then they'll just eat it because they look at the sign on the bag and it says pre-washed. This is where stupid comes in. I lived in Stanislaus County. It's a part of the big breadbasket area of the western United States. And they grew tomatoes and lettuce. You know how they wash them? The trucks come in and they have about a 20,000-gallon hole in the ground that is full of water and bleach. And they just dump all the vegetables in there. And then they all get picked up on a conveyor belt and taken into the plant for filling or processing or what have you. That's what they consider washing. So the majority of people that work in these plants are Mexicans, illegal aliens. They have no concept of hygiene unless they're taught it. So now you have salmonella, listeria, and a half a dozen other diseases that are getting put onto these vegetables and fruits. And the latest one is carrots. This is ridiculous. People don't wash their food. You have to. Carrots nationwide are being recalled because of salmonella concerns. Now, I will have the links up to explain all of this stuff. I have not had the chance to put my links up. At armchairsurvivalist.com, I have a page for show notes. I've not had the chance. I've been too busy with other things. This whole communist takeover has taken up most of my time. But my son is working diligently to get the formats down to where I can put up the show notes for the past 3 or 4 shows. I'll have these up. Yeah. Felix the cat just said hi. Now, I have a bunch of different articles here. I'm not going to read any of them, but they're talking about grain shortages and the problems that have happened worldwide with the floods and the droughts and the excessive heat. But the Ice Age farmer sums it up much better than I.
Even as news of a corn shortage hits mainstream media here in the U.S., the rest of the world still thinks that we can import all the food we need from the United States. China has just had massive losses, both of pigs and grains, in this most recent round of flooding and the typhoon. The Henan province, which was tremendously hit with the flooding, is actually responsible for about 10% of their total grain production. This is not something that China can easily absorb right now, and so they'll be frantically continuing to import, probably from the U.S. Brazil just yesterday announced that they were importing 30 boatloads, literal boatloads, of corn from their neighbor Argentina, which actually gives us some insight into just how badly their safrinha crop, their third crop of corn, failed this past season. Brazil, of course, is one of the top 3 producers and exporters of corn. When we see the breadbaskets of the world, the top producers and exporters that feed the rest of the countries that import food, now saying, crap, we don't have food, and frantically trying to import. This is as huge a red flag as you can imagine about the state of the global food supply. And in fact, it will be, of course, analysts are saying it will be the United States from whom Brazil is forced to import grain come this winter. And as this response says, pretty much everybody will be importing from the United States. That's not really a joke. Here we read from Mexico that they've actually increased their imports about 14%, even though they're trying to become food self-sufficient with respect to grains. This last 6 months, again, frantically started importing from the United States, and they're being impacted by the drought as well right now. When you look down the list of where in the world the corn comes from, almost all of these nations are having agricultural difficulties right now. And in many cases, it's pretty clear that these are deliberate and engineered from the weather warfare that's being used to aggravate precipitative and temperature extremes, the flooding and the droughts, the closures of ports and the stoppage of rail service. the chaos throughout the shipping and supply chains, which are faltering under the lockdowns and pressures there, the fuel shortages, dumping water and turning off irrigation to farmers, all of these are causing, as you can imagine, tremendous problems for the global food supply, bringing us closer to the future that the technocrats have envisioned for us, where food is just tremendously expensive, can barely afford it, and so of course we all need that universal basic income just to be able to afford the fake foodstuffs, which are probably being upcycled from trash anyway. Here's just one latest view into that, as it was announced that scientists have developed something which turns plastic, recycles it into an edible protein. That is the post-animal economy, the world without animals that they want when your protein comes from leftover plastics. And that's where we're headed if we don't stop these attacks on our food supply, or if you don't start growing your own food. So, in the height of hypocrisy, the BBC, who I think is the king of censorship, has called out China for hiding data about the extent of damages in the floods in the Henan province. Although that's sort of ridiculous that the BBC has to accuse them of hiding data, it is indicative of the fact that China is not being forthcoming at all about how bad the situation there in Henan and more broadly was. Here from Reuters, the sky has fallen. Chinese farmers are losing their livelihood in these floods. And we read that just this past round of flooding was responsible for 71 deaths, but also, notably, more than 1 million animals perished and over 1,600 large livestock farms were affected. The article goes on to have quotes, this article from SCMP goes on to have quotes from farmers who are saying, I don't even want to do this anymore. I'm getting out. I'm tired of this. Bring me into that post-animal economy. I don't want to raise livestock anymore. We have no more money to raise pigs again. And then this quote down here, quote, I just don't feel like raising pigs anymore. So it's working, right? The war on ranchers and farmers is a successful one as they're driven out of business or just their morale is destroyed. But it's also just staggering, some of these quotes. I'm waiting for the water levels to go down to see what to do with my remaining pigs. They've been in the water for a few days now and they can't eat. Probably I won't have even one pig left right now. So Henan, which again is responsible for a bulk of Chinese pig production, hog production, was flooded out. And it's not even just the immediate damage that's the most problematic here. It's also that there's a lot of pools of manure and other industrial byproducts around the area that when an area floods like this, just gets washed everywhere. And so it is a disgusting, filthy, disease-ridden mess right there. And there are a lot of analysts who are saying that there's a good chance there'll be another outbreak now, a renewed outbreak of African swine fever, which, as you remember, decimated their hog production 2 years ago. It was like 60% of their pigs had to be killed off because of African swine fever. So this quote, it's as if the sky has fallen, is pretty accurate. Like I said, though, it's not just the pigs. Here from Global Times, we read the torrential Henan rains are sparking concern over grains production. The nation's food supply in China is now at risk as the province is one of China's leading grain producers. Over 712,000 hectares of crops, accounting for 9% of the fall crop area, were affected by these floods. And that is just a mind-numbingly stunning extent. It's just huge. It's incomprehensibly large. Quote, the production gap of Henan is irreplaceable in China and globally. I mean, it's gone. If you can't get that back, it's irreplaceable, period. As the province alone accounts for nearly 10% of China's total grain production and more than a quarter of their summer grain crop. This goes on to say that wheat was also damaged. Remember, wheat is already at a premium and is a harbinger of starvation generally. The quality of the wheat will also be affected after being soaked in water, so market prices will rise further. Food prices through the roof by design. Zero Hedge concluded in their coverage of this by saying China may have to continue buying U.S. farm goods due to an already devastating flood season. So there's one of the world's biggest top producers just lost 10% of all of their grains and is going to be buying from whom? From the U.S. It's also worth noting, got pigs killed, grains destroyed, And of course, the ports were forced to close there as well. And between Ningbo and Shanghai, there's a ton of container traffic there. So this is just stirring up that pot of shipping delays and container shortages even worse. All right, in Brazil, JBS has imported 30 shiploads of Argentinian corn. Here from worldgrain.com, JBS, the world's largest meat packer, imported 30 shiploads of corn from Argentina into Brazil. Why? Due to a crop failure in Brazil. Now, that is their second crop of corn, the safrinha, which you can read down here, represents between 70 to 75% of all output in a given year, and is the country's biggest corn crop. It's also where they get the corn that they're going to export, usually. So this takes that corn off the global market. Brazil will export 15 million tons less of corn, and not only that, they're going to import 4 million tons more, so it's you can see that the supply of corn in the world is being chipped away at quite substantially when you look at China losing 10% of their grain production, some amount of 10%, and then Brazil losing a lot of their corn, their safrinha crop, numbers 2 and 3 producers of corn in the world. That's why everyone has all eyes on the United States right now. But of course, what's going on in the United States? Corn shortages.
Farmers say it's too late for any kind of rain to save their crops, and it's time to move forward with whatever is in the fields.
Around the state, it's a similar picture. Dead spots in fields. Clark Price of Washburn is the fourth generation on this land, and it's difficult to compare this year to any he's seen.
We all had hope for it early on, but the wheat crop kind of fizzled out early. It didn't get enough rain early to hardly even come out of the ground, so that kind of quit. But we had pretty good hope for the corn and the beans, but as the temperatures are staying in the 90s and above, it, no rain, it's shutting all them off too. So pretty likely this won't be a corn crop.
What should be a full ear of corn resembles baby corn, and even that is hard to find. This crop will likely become feed for cattle just to get any use from it.
The corn crop, our feedstock supply in our traditional market area is very questionable right now. All I can say is that we're very concerned.
Yep, so within the U.S., states are competing for the supplies of corn. It's basically a microcosm of what's going on across the world as nations look around frantically to see, does anyone have corn I can buy right now? And prices just keep going up. Ultimately, it will be we, the consumers, who end up paying those prices unless we grow our own food. And probably is a pretty good idea right about now, don't you think? Here's one report on how disastrous the drought has become for the United States. Quote, the drought has become particularly hard for Western farmers and ranchers, many of whom are facing water scarcity, stunting crops, and thinning herds as ranchers sell off their livestock because of feed shortages. Jeff Schaefer described a landscape of crops in his state that are boot high instead of armpit high, pasture grass that never did turn green, and cows grazing on brown grass in June. As a result, quote, we're seeing 10 to 25% herd reductions. And the story is the same in Canada. We read here from producer.com, crunch, crunch, crunch. That is the sound of parched prairie crops burning to a crisp under a heat wave that is baking Western Canadian crops this week. It might also describe the financial situation that farmers and ranchers will face this year as income prospects dwindle and the full impact of a looming feed shortage comes into greater focus for cattle producers. Livestock producers are scrutinizing animal numbers and keeping a close eye on markets, wondering when to begin culling their herds before feeding season arises. And since that's one thing we keep hearing in the mainstream media about this feed crisis for animals, I just want to point out this article again. It's been now a couple months since it ran. Why the nation's food crisis is more of a feed challenge, that pointed out that it was a problem that humans are competing with this livestock industry to be able to feed them. And this said, this is why we need to consider getting rid of livestock and producing alternative proteins, because right now we're going to have a food shortage because we keep feeding all the grains we grow to animals. Never mind the fact that usually it's lower quality grains that are turned into animal feed. They want to pit you against animals so that when we go to the store and have empty shelves or just ridiculously high prices, that we consumers, this is problem, classic problem reaction solution, right? Problem, food gets super expensive. Reaction, people freak out. Solution, that they are prescripting now. We got to get rid of the animals. oops, they ate all of our grains that you were going to eat. Enter the post-animal economy. This is the script that they've laid out years ago, and we're walking through it now. So I hope you are paying attention at home. This is why I've been talking about this for years, because they told us all it was coming, and they told us all where they would be taking us based on this problem reaction solution. And now that we're seeing it, and now that the shelves are empty in UK supermarkets because of a truck driver shortage and a pingdemic, right? They gave us all these different reasons, but the bottom line is food prices are exploding, food availability is shrinking, and they want you to eat the bugs and upcycle the plastic. And of course, then there's even the more important bottom line, which is that if you don't have food, it doesn't matter if you have a First Amendment or a Second Amendment. You'll give up anything just to be able to feed your family. It's almost as if the framers of the Constitution overlooked that. I mean, to be fair, it was 250 years ago, and you couldn't even imagine some dystopic future where companies had taken control over the global food supply and outlawed your ability to grow food. It's just unimaginable. And yet, here we are.
Now, this article is supposed to be under health, but I put it here just to point out how important this is. There has been a large study on chipping. You know how you chip your dogs and cats so that people, if they find them, take them to a vet, and the vet takes this little reader and you can read the chip and go, oh, this is Fred's. Yeah. Okay, so the problem is these microchips are passive. They don't broadcast. They're passive until they're hit with a radio frequency that activates them. Unfortunately, what's happening is there has been thousands and thousands of cancerous tumors in laboratory rodents and in dogs who have had these chips. You might want to think again about chipping your animal or remove the chip. Literally, almost every single animal that's had the chip has had some kind of a tumor or cancerous growth around that area. Look, it's only a couple bucks at the store to go into that machine and print out a little collar tag, like Felix. Felix has his collar tag. On one side it says Felix. On the other side it says, please keep this bastard. No, it says 1-800-753-1981. So how hard is that? You don't need a chip. You just put it on a collar. Collar on the critter. So I just wanted to bring that in. Now, I have so much data under health, I don't have it organized. So I'm basically going to read this off as I come to it. This past week, You heard me get a little hot under the collar about this fraud the CDC has been perpetrating called the PCR test, and how they came out and said this test is no longer valid. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. Stop using it. So a lot of you started posting that, and guess what? Facebook and Google and the rest of them think it's false information. So they're flagging and removing that data as quickly as it's put up. This is right directly from the CDC's website. This is how communists take over. They control communication. In 1972, the World Health Organization came out and explained how, by using a vaccine, you can kill off lots of people. WHO Bulletin number 47, number 2, Memorandum 1 and 2. Basically, what they said was, and I'll read this to you. Animal Models and Implications for Human Disease is what it was called. And what it does, it shows the outline of the ability to create biological weapons in the form of vaccines that, number one, totally disable the immune system. Number two, load every cell of the victim's body up with infection. And number three, switch the immune system on, causing the host to kill themselves in a cytokine storm. Basically, this is what this vaccine does. And I read to you the tests where the spike protein that they inject into your shoulder ends up in every cell of your body. And then when your immune system comes on, you die from a cytokine storm. And I explained that to you before. Very simple. 1, 2, 3, dead. 1972. Interesting, isn't it? I have copies of 47 studies that confirm the ineffectiveness of masks. And I have 32 studies that confirm negative health results from wearing a mask. I'll have these posted up. Now, the powers that be, the CIA, and all mainstream media, including Fox News, exactly along with ABC, CBS, NBC, MSNBC, PBS. They're screaming about this Delta variant. It's not a variant. It's a mutation, and it's caused by people who have had the vaccination. Do you know our COVID-19 deaths hit a 16-month low this month? I've got too many of these links to read, and there's so many of them, it's ridiculous. But basically, the bottom line is this. This new variant, it's not a new variant, it's a mutation caused by the vaccination. People who have been vaccinated are creating this so-called variant. As a matter of fact, up to 75% of people who are admitted to hospitals throughout the world have fully been vaccinated already, and they have this new variant, quote unquote. How much of this crap are we supposed to continue believing? This is astounding when people are literally stupid enough to believe this crap over and over and over again.
If you lie to the government, they'll put you in prison. But when they lie to all of us, it's called being a politician. You think taking guns away will save our kids from the killings? But you're pro-choice, abortion kills way more children. If America's so terrible and racist, it probably isn't safe to encourage immigration. Just saying, all the contradictions are embarrassing. You know who hates America the most? Americans. Trigger warnings used to be on TV for seizures, and now they're everywhere to protect millennials' feelings. He, she, his, him, hers, them, they. Screw up pronouns, cause everyone's a retard these days. I hear him preaching at the protest that hatred's the problem, but hating straight men, white folks, and Christians is common. Coca-Cola telling people they should be less white. They preach intolerance, but if you disagree, they fight. There's a race war here, elections based on fear. Black lives only matter once every 4 years. Soldiers died for this country, and every one of us benefits. Give welfare to the bums and forget about the veterans. Black folks and white folks divided by the news, but we are all the same. We are red, white, and blue. Ashamed to be American? Okay, that's cool. Cause honestly, we are all ashamed of you too.
Y'all are so fake. Oh no. The forecast said that there'd be snowflakes. Whoa. You can make us see it your way. No way. Gasoline and propane. More flames. Oh no.
So this is the liberal psychosis category. Do you know the New York Times did a story on the Cubans in Cuba were fighting. They were yelling and saying, we want freedom, we want freedom. And the New York Times said, the word freedom is anti-government. The word freedom is anti-government. ESPN has this communist black racist writer, and he's at the Olympics. And that's a whole different story, let me tell you. He's at the Olympics, and he's disturbed because there's too many American flags there. And as we all know, American flags are a sign of white nationalism. Chicago has decided they know how to handle the police. They know what they're going to do. They're going to hire a bunch of black communist racists as civilian commissioners to oversee the police. That's perfect. We know that's going to go over really well. Now, the UN is going to be flagging white supremacists and far-right militias. This is an organization, Global Internet Forum to Counter Terrorism. They're going to be monitoring everything because the UN is going to flag all this stuff for them. And because the UN is the organization that's in charge of the world, you've got to listen to what they have to say, don't you? You know all these groups that are trying to defund police? We're going to talk about that in a minute. But George Soros just gave him $1 million. Gave him $1 million. There's an article I got here at a medical school. I wasn't sure where to put this one, but I'm putting it right here. Under the liberal psychosis. In medical school, you're not allowed to differentiate male and female any longer. You're not allowed to do that. Isn't that smart? Don't you want to get a gynecologist who's not allowed to acknowledge the concept of female? Judge Jeanine has something to say about this, and it sounds exactly like what I've been saying.
America as we know it is coming to an end. We are watching it in real time. It is moving so quickly that when it's gone, we won't be able to predict the exact moment it happened. What I fought for in law enforcement for over three decades, what my father and grandfather fought for in World War II, what you and your parents and grandparents fought for is ending. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? How many of us would describe life today as being what our founding fathers intended? If we don't speak in politically correct terms, we are canceled. We lose our jobs. Erased. They did it to a president of the United States. Big tech decides what we can read and what we can post with no regulation or government interference. Our kids are taught in school that the color of their skin determines whether they are victims or oppressors. I could go on, but one thing, more than any other, that signals the ruination of a society and trumps all else is crime. When crime is not prosecuted, when criminals are not arrested, lawlessness, anarchy, and chaos result. Dominoes continue to fall, and we witness the crippling effect of crime. You see, crime not only harms the victim, it visits the loved ones, family, friends, neighbors, and the community at large. Fear becomes generalized. It immobilizes people. On the other hand, criminals are emboldened to continue their rampage. Businesses cannot prosper where crime is rampant. Families are not safe where crime is raging. Schools close, churches merge, hospitals fail, people become depressed and dependent. And add to that a pandemic where the unequal enforcement of rules by the left-wing totalitarian Democrats is infuriating. But don't be fooled. This isn't just a few malcontents like the squad. What we're experiencing is part of a massive plan orchestrated by culture haters, American-hating, power-hungry individuals who despise America, democracy, capitalism, and everything that we hold dear. Right now, they're winning. Respect for the rule of law is gone in most Democrat-run big cities, and as a result, there is chaos and crime. Criminals believe they're entitled to take whatever they need from stores. They're not afraid of the police who've been defunded and hamstrung without the ability to enforce the law, and certainly not the backup if they do. Take a look at TJ Maxx this week. Criminals loading up and walking out, not even running. And even if there were police to arrest them, prosecutors in California are not handling cases of less than $950. The result? Criminals reoffend without fear of prosecution. All of this began with a harebrained idea of bail reform, a euphemism for a get out of jail free. This week, after shots were fired in our nation's capital, only days after shots rang out at a baseball game in Washington, D.C., Washington sounded like a war zone. It sounded like Beirut.
And I've been telling you, and so has everyone else, get involved. Get involved. Well, let me tell you something. Here's this woman. Her name is Carrie Lake. She used to work for the mainstream media, and now she's getting involved.
It's time to take a sledgehammer to the mainstream media's lies and propaganda. Corporate media establishment flat out lies to people, and no one is holding them accountable. They exploit misinformation. They use it to manipulate the masses. They use fear-mongering to create a scared and broken population. It's right out of a communist playbook. I know this because I used to work for the mainstream media. I'm Carrie Lake. You might recognize me from TV. I worked as a journalist and a news anchor for 27 years right here in Arizona. So I know the ins and outs of the corporate media. And I know how corrupt it is. The network overlords craft a narrative. They pump it out to their affiliates, and all of the anchors parrot the exact same thing.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
These media giants have absolute and total control over the information we, the people, consume. They control what we know, and then they tell us how to feel about it.
None of this makes sense to me.
It's not reporting. It's propaganda. And it's biased. It's unethical. Journalism is dead. And as soon as I realized it, I got out. I'm not afraid of the media, and I don't care what they say about me. I care about the people of Arizona. And I'm ready to have a real and honest conversation about what the hell is going on in our state today. Even though we live in the desert, we still have our own swamp. They've had the same establishment cabal running this state for too long. No matter who gets in, nothing changes. Illegal immigration at the border is out of control. Our weak, recycled politicians have lost control to the cartels. Our election integrity is wrecked. Our schools are pushing racist garbage onto our children, and violent crime has skyrocketed. The left wants to burn down our businesses, but if you dare question the narrative, they'll label you a conspiracy theorist. The real conspiracy theorists are spreading fake news from CNN right down to your local news station. We have lost our way. And that's why I'm stepping up to run for governor of Arizona, to get us back on track. I'm ready to take a sledgehammer to the corrupt media, to destroy the corrupt cronyism that's been in Arizona far too long, and to take a sledgehammer to these weak border policies that are ruining our state. But I will never take a sledgehammer to that big, beautiful wall. As a matter of fact, when I'm governor, we'll finish the damn wall. We don't want Arizona to become a suburb of California. And trust me, when I'm your governor, I'll keep that California crap out of here.
Now we're going into commie racism. The ACLU. This is an organization that was founded by communist Jews, and almost every single member of the ACLU is still a Jew and a communist. They claim the Second Amendment is racist. What is that, news? I mean, I don't know. Okay. NPR, which survives solely because the federal government pays it, National Public Radio, which is on television as well and is funded about 80% by the federal government. NPR hates America. NPR hates whites. It hates Christians. You know, they have all these neat little shows on there. One of them is Reframing America. There's no white people on there, and if they are, they are portrayed as bumpkins, hicks, racists, murderers, or what have you. They have stories on blacks, stories on Indians, stories on sexual perverts. But anyway, they're allowing all of their employees to join anti-American organizations. Obviously, communist USA, they're allowing them to become communists. In fact, most of them are communists already. They're allowing them to join Black Lives Matter and Antifa and that kind of stuff. Did you, by any chance, watch any of the so-called hearings on January 1st? You know, the hearings when the White House, when the Capitol was invaded? Did you watch any of the hearings? This one black... I looked at all of them. There were four police there. Every one of them was a racist. Every one of them was a Democrat. Every one of them was a communist. And this one is a monstrous pig. How he can be a cop anywhere, he couldn't run 10 feet. He is a typical communist black racist. As a matter of fact, he's a member of Black Lives Matter. And he was working as a guard, as a Capitol Police. And that female in Chicago, that cross between Beetlebub and a lizard, I'm pretty sure it is a female, though. She won't talk to white reporters. And that's not racist. That's not at all. Now, here is another article on control. PayPal, the largest group on the internet for transferring funds from one person to another. Like, you can use your PayPal account and go online and buy things from eBay or Amazon or what have you. Or people can pay your PayPal account. Well, they have decided that they want to step into the fray and stop funding hate groups and extremists. And who's going to tell them who's a hate group and extremists? Well, a communist Jewish organization called the Anti-Defamation League. I'm going to do a whole show on the ADL. I did years ago. They are a communist organization that they do everything in their power to destroy the United States. They don't say that because they're a Jewish organization, and you know, there are certain groups you're not allowed to talk about, and especially if they have the J in front of their designation. But the ADL is going to be telling PayPal who they should not allow to function. We got stopped by PayPal years ago. We were doing $1 million a year when we were selling food. And because I had a radio show, and I'm slightly to the right of Attila the Hun, PayPal decided that they would illegally shut me down. Now, I don't mind if they shut me down, but the thing was, they wanted to steal my money and hold it for 90 days. And I had like $150,000 in the account. Soon as I got wind that they were going to do that, I went and transferred everything out. Oh, they got pissed off. They didn't get anything. They got $15. That's all they got. Now, the CRT thing, this is a big thing, the critical race theory. Because it's getting such a bad name, which it already had, they're changing the designation, and you people need to pay attention to what I'm going to tell you. They're changing the name. They're changing it to different things. Critical pedagogy, critical social justice, cultural competence, diversity, equity, inclusion. You hear that word anywhere, that's racist training. Anti-racism is racist training. Social emotional learning. Now this is SEL. Social emotional learning, SEL. Educational equity. Trauma-informed, culturally responsive learning. Now, if you want to know, all of this crap is being shoved down our throats by the communists in the United States. Any person who promotes it, any person who allows it, is a communist. Now, they might not use the word communist, but they will use the word Democrat, which is the exact same thing. And I've warned you about this, and so has many other people. These communists gain a foothold in the educational system by being put in as county commissioners, as the education commissioners, school board, these kind of groups. This is where they insinuate themselves into so that they can force your children to learn communism and racism. And that's exactly what they're doing. You want an example of what happens when a whole nation goes through this critical race theory crap? Look at what's happening in South Africa right now. South Africa is a culmination of what we're being taught here. That is it. Critical race theory. Thousands and thousands and thousands of racist blacks who have been emboldened by their government's hatred for white people. So they're busy robbing and looting and killing each other. See, that's how you protest white racists, I guess, is by killing each other. But that's what they're doing. And I get videos every day, different examples, and some of them are heinous. I wouldn't even talk about them. That's what they're pushing for here. See, the United States is different than any other subjugated nation on Earth. Not just the fact that we have guns, and most of us know how to use them, but it's also because we are the world's fighters. We are the only country on Earth that fought a revolution to gain our independence and have kept it for hundreds of years. Be that as it may, and of course there's underlying currents of involvement with other agencies and countries controlling the United States, but you know, so what? You can get in your car, you can drive over to the store and buy stuff, you can go out to the woods and do some target practicing, you can buy a gun, you can buy ammo. Yeah, that doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. So they have to perform certain tasks to break us down. This is what's occurring now. And I'm going to read this to you right now. This is something that everybody should know. Communism has goals. They came out with these goals in the early 50s. These goals were discovered and read into the Senate's speeches. And I'm going to read them to you. These are 45 goals of communism. Now, you can look at these things and you can determine for yourself which political party in the United States has pushed and achieved each of these goals, if any of them have been achieved. Number one, U.S. acceptance of coexistence as the only alternative to atomic war. In other words, let's kiss the butt of the Russians and Chinese because we don't want atomic war. Well, check, that's been done. Number two, U.S. willingness to capitulate in preference to engaging in atomic war. Okay, that's been done. Three, develop the illusion that total disarmament by the U.S. would be a demonstration of moral strength. Well, that's been done. except we haven't totally disarmed, but we are in disarmament agreements with Soviet Union, Russia, and China and all. Permit free trade between all nations, regardless of communist affiliation and regardless of whether or not items could be used for war. Number five. Now, these are real. These are goals of communism. Extension of long-term loans to Russia and Soviet satellites. That's done. Six. Provide American aid to all nations, regardless of communist dominion. That's done. Seven. Grant recognition of Red China. Admission of China to the UN. That's done. Set up East and West Germany as separate states in spite of Khrushchev's promise in 1955 to settle the German question by free elections under supervision of the UN. Nah, that's not been done yet. Number nine, prolong the conferences to ban atomic tests because the United States has agreed to suspend tests as long as negotiations are in progress. And they have been for, what is it, 40 years, 50 years? 10, allow Soviet satellites individual representation in the UN. They've done that. 11. Promote the UN as the only hope for mankind. Yeah. If its charter is rewritten, demand that it be set up as a one-world government with its own independent armed forces. Guess what? Been done. Some communist leaders believe the world can be taken over as easily by the UN as by Moscow. Sometimes these two centers compete with each other as they are now doing in the Congo. Now remember, this was read into the Senate in 1963. 12. Resist any attempt to outlaw the Communist Party. There, in 1954, the Communist Party was outlawed. Magically, it's changed. 13. Do away with all loyalty oaths. That's happening. As a matter of fact, the abomination was sworn in, and he didn't even take an oath. 14. Continue giving Russia access to the U.S. Patent Office. Now, why would that be? So they can steal all the ideas that the U.S. citizens come up with. Which gives me a point here. If you invent something, don't patent it. If you invent something, what you do is you fake it. You put something on the back of it or the bottom of it and claim patent pending. Okay? That means you intend to patent it, but it's pending. Number 16, capture one or both of the political parties in the United States. Well, that's been done. The Democrats are all communists. And I would say, now when I say Democrats, I mean the politicians. All Democrat politicians are communists. And about 50% of the Republican politicians are communists. 16, use technical decisions of the courts to weaken basic American institution by claiming their activities violate civil rights. Now, we're watching this every single day. 17. Get control of the schools. Use them as transmission belts for socialism and current communist propaganda. Soften the curriculum. Get control of teachers' association. Put the party line in textbooks. That's been done. The teachers' associations, the NEA, and all of the other teacher associations are communists. They're all communists. So what are they doing? They're getting control of the students and pushing socialism. 18, gain control of student newspapers. And what they're talking about is high school and college newspapers. And yes, that's happened. 19, use student riots to foment public protests against programs or organizations which are under communist attack. In other words, use useless eaters and useful idiots to defend communism. 20. Infiltrate the press. Well, duh. Get control of book reviewing assignments, editorial writing, policy making positions. More than that, all press now, 95% are communists. 21. Gain control of key positions in radio, TV, and motion pictures. Okay. There's only been two of these up here that haven't been done yet. 22. Continue discrediting American culture by degrading all forms of artistic expression. An American communist cell was told to eliminate all good sculpture from parks and buildings, substitute shapeless, awkward, and meaningless forms. Even in Coeur d'Alene, they pulled that crap. The city council, which are all communists, decided to hire artists to put weird artwork on each corner downtown. Coeur d'Alene. You wouldn't believe some of the oddball crap they put down there. 23. Control art critics and directions of art museums. Our plan is to promote ugliness, repulsive, meaningless art. You ever seen a cross in a jar of urine? Yeah, that's what art is now. 24. Eliminate laws governing obscenity by calling them censorship and violation of free speech and free press. Yep. 25. Break down cultural standards of morality by promoting pornography and obscenity in books, magazines, motion pictures, radio, and TV. Yeah. You ever look at Netflix sometimes? 26. Present homosexuality, degeneracy, and promiscuity as normal, natural, and healthy. Oh, that's happening every day. Especially when you have a transvestite as a weightlifter for New Zealand being shown at the Olympics. I mentioned the Olympics. Present homosexuality, degeneracy, and promiscuity as normal, natural, and healthy. So here we have a whole soccer team of female lesbians. Disgusting anti-American creatures. And then there's racist black communists there that are promoting communist organizations like Black Lives Matter. It's the Olympics. This is the worst viewing in history for the Olympics. And this is the worst showing for the Americans in the Olympics ever, because too many of them are nothing more than activists. 27. Infiltrate the churches and replace revealed religion with social religion. That's happening like crazy. Discredit the Bible and emphasize the need for intellectual maturity, which does not need a religious crutch. 28. Eliminate prayer or any phrase of religious expression in schools on the ground that it violates the principle of separation of church and state. You understand, these communist goals came out before all of these things were done. And then all of these things got done. 29. Discredit the American Constitution by calling it inadequate, old-fashioned, out of step, hindrance to cooperation between nations on a worldwide basis. Gee, sounds like every Democrat. 30. Discredit the American Founding Fathers. Present them as selfish aristocrats who had no concern for the common man. Oh, and racist, too. Got to get that in. 31. Belittle all forms of American culture and discourage the teaching of American history on the ground it was only a minor part of the big picture. Give more emphasis to Russian history since the communists took over. See, they're modifying some of these things. Like, belittle all forms of American culture and discourage the teaching of American history. To belittle that, they pervert American history to make it look like all the historical features were phony, lies, built on racism, blah, blah, blah. 32. Support any social movement to give centralized control over any part of the cultural education, social agencies, welfare programs, mental health clinics, etc. So support any social movement. This is, that's socialism. That's the health system that we're under here now in the United States. 33. Eliminate laws or procedures which interfere with the operation of the communist apparatus. This communist apparatus is basically all the Democrats that are doing, passing laws, controlling commerce, school boards, county commissioners, city commissioners, city council members. They want all of their actions not to be interfered with. And you can see this now in the White House. They're rescinding laws and regulations that protect us against communist actions. 34. Eliminate the House Committee on Un-American Affairs. Is that still in existence? 35. Discredit and eventually dismantle the FBI. Well, that's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? The FBI is discrediting itself. 36. Infiltrate and gain control of more unions. Well, that's a redundancy, because unions are communism. 37. Infiltrate and gain control of big business. Now, big business. You see all these corporations that are towing the Black Lives Matter line, that are censoring people. Well, that's number 37. Communists are in complete control. Now, there's some big businesses out there, but they're few and far between, that aren't under communist control. 38, transfer some of the powers of arrest from police to social agencies. Treat all behavioral problems as psychiatric disorders, which no one but psychiatrists can understand. Now, understand what I've taught you before. Psychiatry was created by a Jewish communist. That's why they have this number 38. And that's why you see in many parts of the United States, as they defund the police, they start sending out social workers instead of police when there's a call. 39. Dominate the psychiatric profession and use mental health laws as a means of gaining coercive control over those who oppose communist goals. It's very simple. They have already done that. The psychiatric profession are all trained using the tenets of a communist Jewish group. You want to buy a gun? Well, you have a psychiatric disorder. This is the way that they play it. If you vote for Trump, you have a psychiatric disorder. Number 40. Now, you got to remember, all of these were done before 1963. 1963 was when these were read into the records. Number 40. Discredit the family as an institution. Well, they not only discredited the family, they perverted it to mean all kinds of other things. 41. Emphasize the need to raise children away from the negative influence of parents. Attribute prejudices, mental blocks, and retarding of children to suppressive influence of parents. That's so common it sounds like it's a joke, but it's real. 42. Create the impression that violence and insurrection are legitimate aspects of the American tradition. Gee, have you seen this one come true yet? That students and special interest groups should rise up and use united force to solve economic, political, or social problems. Even the founders of Black Lives Matter have made sure that point number 42 is explained to us. 43. Overthrow all colonial governments before native populations are ready for self-government. Now, what that means is, before we know what the hell we're doing and can take care of ourselves properly, they have to take over so that we need to have somebody control us. 4. Internationalize the Panama Canal. Well, you can't get more international than selling it to the Chinese. 45. Repeal the Connolly Reservation so the U.S. cannot prevent the World Court from seizing jurisdiction over domestic problems. Give the World Court jurisdiction over domestic problems. Give the World Court jurisdiction over nations and individuals alike. Okay, so these 45 goals of communism, you've seen almost all of them happen in your lifetime. And that's just the beginning. People want to know what a communist is. What is a communist? Well, in spite of the propaganda that's spouted, there are two types of communists. One are the rulers. It's a lie when they say communism is for all the people own everything. No, the people, according to communists, are too stupid to control themselves. They are too greedy, they are too dangerous, they are too ignorant to take care of themselves, so they need a ruling class to take care of them. And you'll see this in every communist nation there is, every socialist or communist nation there is. You will see a ruling class. Okay. Now, there are subcategories under that. You have the ruling class, which could be a dictator and his commission, his group, or it could be an organization that controls everything else. So you'll have the elite, then you'll have the minions. These are the groups that teach the communisms. There are different versions of it, like the teachers and the priests and the preachers. Okay, so you have the elite, the rulers, then you have the mouthpieces, and then you have the common man. proletariat. And the proletariat has to be controlled for their own good. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's not a question. That's a known fact worldwide. So in communism, you have the people that want to rule everything. And you see these people in Washington, D.C. You see Chuck Schumer. He's one of the elite. He controls a lot. And you see Nancy Pelosi, who she thinks she is herself a god. You see all the other Democrats. You're getting the idea, even without me telling you that Democrats are evil. You can figure this out yourself. They are the ones that are promoting all things communism. They're the ones promoting the destruction of the family. They're the ones promoting sexual perversion being taught in the public schools from the age of two. I've got a whole page full of perverted crap that the Democrats are pushing in schools in the United States. And those of you who think that, yo, well, I'm better. I got my kid in a charter school, or I got my kid in a Christian school or a Catholic school. Why don't you take your blinders off and go down there and audit the class? Sit in on all the classes. You'll be surprised what your children are being taught. You'll be surprised what they're being told. We have lost the United States. We have lost this country. And this is what Judge Jeanine said. And unfortunately, I haven't a clue how we're going to take it back, short of some cataclysmic action. But you look around. You've heard the saying, you shall know them by their deeds. Well, sometimes their deeds are invisible, but their words aren't. So listen to these people. Listen to people talk around you. Are these people communists? Do they want complete control of a government entity? Do they want banning of firearms and you not have the ability to defend yourself and your family? Do they want the government telling you what you can drive, what you can eat, what you can wear, where you can go? Do they think it's okay that people have to have papers to travel from one place to another? Or a specialized visa so that they can even get access to Costco or to a place to eat or to buy gasoline or to even leave their house? Do they think that all children should be taught perversion and taken away from their parents if their parents don't agree with it? Listen to the people around you. Listen to how they talk. Don't be confused because they smile and have a pretty face or a nice figure or like you. Learn to tell the enemy. These are the enemy. The people who want these things are the enemy of America. If you agree with these things, you're an enemy of America. And it's very simple. It's cut and dry. Anything that promotes destruction of the American way of life or the founding fathers is evil. Now, I'm not saying these guys were all sterling characters, but for their time, hundreds of years ago, they were. We're in a category of government threat now. You know, and you probably heard this, Border Patrol is shipping these criminal aliens that cross the border. You know, they're not even covert about it. They literally walk through the opening in the border wall that the Democrats have ordered to stay open. And then they're arrested, and then they're processed, if they're even processed now, and then put on a bus and shipped anywhere in the United States. Border Patrol is sending them everywhere. The Department of Homeland Security has canceled 31 miles of fencing on the Texas border. You know that? You know, that female, she was a prostitute at one time in San Francisco. Oh, the vice president, that's who it was. She went to Guatemala and everywhere in South America to discover exactly why all of these aliens are criminally coming north and then illegally entering our borders here. So she's decided that the reason is, is that we're not giving enough money to the countries in South America. So that's going to be tacked on to the infrastructure bill to the tune of billions point something or other. Tucker Carlson has a little thing to say about this whole thing.
New developments on the southern border tonight. It's becoming obvious that open borders are, in effect, the policy, the official policy of the Biden administration. Axios reports tonight that approximately 50,000 migrants caught crossing the southern border have been released into our country without a court date. Now, technically, those migrants have been instructed to report to ICE offices, but they don't. Studies show only about 10% of them have done. Probably fewer than that will. An immigration official just told this show that this is now standard operating procedure. So you get caught crossing the border, not just from Mexico or Honduras or Guatemala, but maybe from across the ocean, maybe from the Middle East, from Africa, from the Caribbean. And you're told to show up at an ICE office wherever you choose to settle. And according to two whistleblowers from Joe Biden's HHS, many of these migrants are infected with COVID-19. Quote, hundreds of children contracted COVID in the overcrowded conditions in the migrant shelters. The whistleblower said in a new federal complaint, adequate masks were not consistently provided to children, nor was their use consistently enforced. Think about that. Your kindergartner is going to be forced to wear a mask because the teachers' unions are in charge of the Biden administration's health policy. But illegal migrants with COVID don't have to wear masks. How does that work? Well, because they're future Democratic Party voters. They can do what they want. And we know the Biden administration is not even bothering to figure out where they're going. This is one of the great scandals of our age, and no one is stopping it. We went down to the border town of Uvalde, Texas, for a brand new episode of our documentary series. It's called Tucker Carlson Originals. The documentary is called The Illegal Invasion, and it's a look at why so many illegal aliens are flooding the border and what they've done to the people who live there. Here's a look at what we found.
Joe Biden took office in January of 2021. One of the very first things he did was deliberately provoke what may be the largest surge in illegal immigration in American history.
Nobody is going to be deported in my first 100 days.
Foreign nationals from around the world, from Congo to Haiti to Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador to the Middle East, all heard Joe Biden's call.
They're on this one. Ghana. You're from Ghana.
In the first 6 months of the Biden presidency, nearly a million foreign nationals arrived in this country. They came up through Mexico. What is life like for the Americans who live along the Mexican border? We thought we'd find out.
In the last 6 months, it's become the wild, wild west.
Don McLaughlin is the mayor of Uvalde, Texas. Uvalde is about 60 miles from the Mexican border. We interviewed him earlier this year. When we did, he invited us to come visit him in Uvalde. We took him up on the offer. This is what we found.
The mass arrival of foreign nationals into this small Texas town has made life miserable for the people who live there.
This has become a third world country.
Weston Robertson lives on 22 acres near the railroad tracks.
I carry a firearm 24 hours a day out here all the time. Even my mother, who is elderly, will not even leave the house, go outside to water flowers without her personally carrying a firearm.
If you live on the edge of town and that, and you're out in your yard, chances are you've got a shotgun or a pistol out there with you. And it shouldn't be that way.
But it is that way. Uvalde residents watch helplessly as Central Americans, Haitians, even people from Africa cross their fields, break into their sheds, and camp on their land.
But they're coming into these cars and spending the night. There's food packets from where they're sitting in here eating.
Since the new administration took office, the federal government is no longer willing to enforce existing immigration law. Americans living in Uvalde have no option but to defend themselves.
I cannot even go from my house to my barn or to their chicken coop or anywhere without carrying a gun. I don't even leave my house without it.
This woman spoke on the condition of anonymity. She fears retaliation from the Mexican cartels, which she says are operating in Uvalde.
I came out one day, had four men running directly at my house, where one tried to break into our house while I was here.
Our crime's up. Our car break-ins are up. Our house burglaries are up.
Seems like we just don't have as many rights as even the illegals do. You know, I will defend my house if I had to.
The main thing that the communists have to do in the United States, and they've done this in every country they've taken over, is they have to squelch all information to the contrary. They have to squelch the truth. In times of deceit, truth is the enemy of the state. So people who spread the truth, people who post the truth, people who talk about the truth online are attacked. As a matter of fact, the communists now have put a group together. You're going to love this. It's called Indivisible. It's a communist organization. and they have publicly launched a massive volunteer program to counter right-wing disinformation, and they call that the Truth Brigade. Thousands of volunteers are getting the training and the tools they need to shift the narratives in their own communities. This is how communists work. This is how communism works all over the world. Every country has to change it a little tiny bit, and the United States is being changed to this. It's a massive effort. And what they're going to do is, well, whatever their communist masters tell them to do. In other words, the Democrats. So if, let's say I post, let's say I go on Facebook and I post a link to the Center for Disease Control website that talks about how all of the statistics of COVID-19 illnesses were mixed in with typical influenza A or influenza B sicknesses as well. This is on their website. You can see this yourself. And if I put that link up there, because it's truth, that's considered misinformation. And all they have to do is notify Facebook, and Facebook will go, why that dirty, low-down American? Let's shut him down. Okay. So this is I'll have this link up, so you'll be able to find these. You know what I wish? I wish we had, we, meaning Americans, I wish we had hackers that could target these creatures of the night that openly come out and say, we're going to attack everything that's American. We're going to do this. We're going to censor you. I wish, you know, some guy is a hacker. I'm not saying I really wish that, but wouldn't that be cool if we had somebody on our side that's willing to go on the... Well, I'll just say defense, because it is an offense. It's defense, because we're being attacked. America is being destroyed. I saw this series called How to Become a Tyrant, and it's drawn from lessons that other tyrants have learned over the years. The concept of communism, never mind the word communism, but the concept of tyranny is what communism is built on. I've got this down into a three-part series. Right now, I'm going to play part number one, and I want you to look at it, listen to it, and I want you to think to yourself, wow, that's happening right now, if you can.
Absolute power. Come on, you know you want it. You just don't know how to get it. But I do. There's a playbook. A series of tactics that history's most infamous tyrants used to achieve unimaginable power, each in his own unique way. Now, there is one small catch. This path does involve making some unpleasant choices, but nobody said ruling was easy. Care to look inside? When I say the word tyrant, what comes to mind? No, too simple. Tyranny is government for people who want results.
When you look at human history, freedom is not the norm. We love being ruled. When you're living in a difficult time, there's an appeal to someone who comes up, finds their moment, and says, I alone can fix it all.
History's most successful tyrants do just that, transforming their societies from top to bottom. By following their path step by step, you can too.
There is a playbook for tyranny. If you want to be a tyrant, you just have to do those few things. That's it.
But before you can do anything, you need to break out from the crowd and grab the reins of power. That's where our story begins. With the failed landscape artist who reinvented himself into the most powerful man on Earth. Here he is, Adolf Hitler, just 1 month after becoming Germany's absolute ruler. So, how exactly did Adolf Hitler become Adolf Hitler? And what lessons can you take from him on your rise to power?
Hitler in his 20s was a disenchanted, broke, friendless, failed artist. I once interviewed someone who had met Hitler, and she sort of said, you know, I found him really remarkably unimpressive. He seemed very weedy, he had a sort of clammy handshake. How is it that this man ends up having this charismatic hold all over this incredibly large country in the middle of Europe in the 20th century?
It's actually quite simple. If you want to rule, you first have to believe that you can.
Tyrants do have a kind of megalomaniacal confidence in their own abilities. They have to have that. They often see themselves as liberators. They are frequently convinced that only they can save the world and make the world a better place.
In other words, they're special. And as you'll see, Hitler wasn't the only one who felt that way. According to North Korean legend, at the moment of Kim Jong-il's birth, a new glowing star lit up the sky. A double rainbow appeared, and winter turned into spring. Saddam Hussein claimed that he was anointed by God to rule Iraq forever, and pointed to the times he escaped death as proof of his divine favor. While Haitian dictator François Duvalier claimed that he himself was an eternal being whose voodoo powers caused the JFK assassination. Who's to say they didn't? But where might you find the source of your otherworldly belief? Hitler claimed that he found his in a most unexpected place, the blood-soaked trenches of World War I. One day while on duty, he hears a strange voice with a message. Move. Several of his comrades are killed immediately, but Hitler emerges without a scratch. Later, as the war nears its end, Hitler and his unit fall victim to mustard gas at the Battle of Ypres. While recovering at a nearby hospital, a pastor gives Hitler the bad news. World War I is over. Germany has surrendered. In shock, he completely loses his sight. A case of hysterical blindness. Then, from the depths of his despair, springs a grand vision for his nation's future. From this point forward, Hitler never doubted his special purpose.
Hitler once said famously, "I walk with the self-assurance of a sleepwalker toward my destiny." Once he had his mission for Germany, he was on autopilot. Nothing would distract him from that aim.
And that's the sort of confidence that any future tyrant needs to get ahead. Although some might use a different term.
The potential dictator is usually highly narcissistic, believe themselves to be the center of the universe, and everything must happen according to their will. And this is very different from ordinary people.
Maybe that's not such a bad thing, but before you can realize your destiny, you still have some big challenges to overcome. For one thing, you don't have any followers yet. In order to launch your rise to power, you'll need a message that stirs people's souls, and there's one surefire place to start. In a perfect world, your society wouldn't need to be guided by the firm hand of a tyrant. But look around you. People are angry and looking for someone to blame.
The genius is understanding the nature of the resentment that already exists, presenting yourself as the means to overcome that, as the means to get even with the people that you resent.
If you want to get your people's attention, the playbook is clear. Show them that their enemies are your enemies, and that you are the one who will take them down. From an early age, future Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi gave fiery speeches against the Western-backed monarchy he called corrupt, and was received as a hero when he toppled them in a coup. The father of North Korea, Kim Il-sung, came to prominence, reminding his people of the humiliations they suffered at the hands of the occupying Japanese army. And as Idi Amin rose to power, he focused the Ugandan people's frustrations on their former colonial master, Britain.
They think that they are the boss in Uganda, but the British imperialism is over.
After the First World War, Germany has got hyperinflation, mass unemployment, and people are taking bucket loads of money to buy a loaf of bread.
And among Germany's disillusioned masses is 30-year-old Adolf Hitler, who's about to take a fateful step on his path to power. Munich, 1919. Adolf Hitler is an unemployed artist with just a few coins in his pocket and strong opinions about where everything went wrong. wrong and who to blame. Hitler gets a job as an army intelligence officer. His first assignment? Observe a meeting of an anti-Semitic right-wing group called the German Workers' Party. Hitler's bosses expect him to lay low, take notes, and report back to headquarters. But Hitler was never great at taking orders. Years of rage and frustration pour out. He rails against the Jewish-led conspiracy holding the proud German people down.
Hitler says that basically the financiers of Wall Street and the communists in Moscow are all one part of the same Jewish plot. And it seems absurd, but that's what Hitler convinces the German people.
Absurd or not, Hitler's words strike a chord. Now a party member, Hitler obsessively perfects his performance.
The content of his speeches was, a lot of it was hateful, and the need to cleanse Germany of Jews. It was vendetta against Germany being humiliated. It was national pride that Germany needed to rise again.
Before long, Hitler is named leader of the party, which takes on a new name, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, otherwise known as the Nazis. Hitler now has a platform to vent his outrage and a loyal group of followers hanging on his every word.
Many Germans found that he was saying what they thought secretly, but had never been able to express.
Why does this work so well? It's because you are giving people permission to be themselves.
Common grievance brings people together, and it feels very good because you have solidarity and you have a strong leader leading you against that minority or that threat from the outside.
Hard to believe people would be so quick to blame others for their misfortune, right?
Let's not try and make out that German people in the 20s are worse people than we are today. If you feel genuinely that there's an enemy within, then you would want your politicians to do something about it. It's very easy for us to sit back and go, I would never, you know, fall for the seductive charms of a tyrant like Hitler. I promise you, you would.
But to achieve absolute power, you'll need more than a compelling message. You also have to sell the messenger. Let the playbook be your guide. As a tyrant, yours will become the face of your nation. And how you present that face will be all up to you. But at this early stage of your journey, the playbook offers very specific advice on how to fashion your image. Show your people you are one of them. Need some examples? Italian dictator Benito Mussolini proudly referred to himself as a man of the people, frequently playing up his humble roots as son of a small-town blacksmith. At the start of his reign, Idi Amin drove himself around Uganda in an open jeep and was known for showing off his accordion skills at public events. While Muammar Gaddafi publicly stayed in touch with his Bedouin roots by dressing in tribal robes and demanding to stay in a tent when he traveled. Who better to make a nation's dreams come true than somebody who feels what they feel? Dreams what they dream.
It's a hallmark of successful tyrants that they achieve this fusion between themselves and the masses. They come forward and say, I am you, you are me. We're a kind of collective organism. Hitler often used to say this in his speeches.
Now, when you're setting yourself up as a man of the people, it's the little things that make all the difference.
Hitler didn't dress up in a lavish fashion. He always wore a uniform. The fact that he came out of the trenches in the First World War, believing that war makes a man, he realized was really important for wooing the masses and solidifying his support.
So what about that mustache?
Mustache metamorphosizes from this very sort of long thing that you see in the First World War in earlier images of Hitler.
But something compelled him to change up his look. One theory is that he trimmed his deluxe Kaiser Wilhelm during the war to fit under a gas mask. Another is that he was using his razor to copy a contemporary German hero, Hans Kippen. Maybe Hitler wasn't thinking about shaving his way into immortality. But sometimes a future tyrant just gets lucky.
It ends up becoming the classic toothbrush moustache, which was used by lower middle class men throughout Europe.
So what Hitler was showing, I am from this kind of background.
Now that you've cemented your bond with the common people, you might be feeling like your date with destiny is at hand, but not so fast. If you want to make history, you'll need to grab people at an even deeper level. Their subconscious.
Coming out of these beer halls in the 1920s, the Nazi Party is growing, but there were dozens of these right-wing parties vying for control.
Like with any product, for your budding movement to break from the pack, you'll need a great marketing strategy. And Hitler was a natural-born ad man.
It's almost as if the machine gives them life, turns them into symbols of ourselves. Queuing up for the future, moved by forces beyond our control, getting on board for a destination that remains vague.
Hitler knew the power of the image. He recognized the power of branding. You didn't just have to have the man, but you also had to have the iconography to go with it. There is almost no more famous brand than the swastika in a white circle on a red banner. It is probably still the most potent icon that's ever existed on this planet.
But as compelling as the right symbol can be, your real power is your people, and they need to be dressed for your success. Hitler put this page of the playbook into action with his brown shirt militia.
That very act of obtaining the uniform and being part of something greater than yourself, being part of a movement, was very significant in the kind of German psyche. That uniform, that meant sacrifice, that meant duty, that meant obedience and loyalty.
In other words, when you're wearing a uniform, it means you're on the team. And who doesn't want to be on the team?
Conformity is definitely one of the chief goals that tyrants strive for. The reason they sometimes succeed is that they're able to convince their followers that this isn't really conformity, it's unity.
By branding and unifying your growing movement, it will soon become impossible to ignore.
Hitler draws people in through that political pageantry, with swastikas, marching people in uniforms, torchlit rallies, powerful speeches. You're going to be tempted. If we're all going to be in it together, and we're all going to take part in this play, let's join in.
But just because you're offering a good show and a sharp look doesn't mean your rise to power is at hand. You're going to need to scale up your operation, and the right staffing decisions will make all the difference.
Nobody governs alone. Not Idi Amin, not Louis XIV, who said, l'état c'est moi, I am the state. Nobody rules alone.
When it comes to seizing power, you'll need a team you can trust to amplify your message and watch your back. To prove my point, Muammar Gaddafi's inner circle of fellow army officers helped him launch his coup against the Libyan king and form the government he would run for over 40 years. Saddam Hussein relied on direct family members or members of his tribe as his main base of support throughout his reign. Joseph Stalin elevated key supporters inside the Soviet Central Committee, which allowed him to eventually purge his rivals and seize total control. But when you're building a team to secure power in the first place, not just anyone will fit the bill. Like every leader, you need people with a diverse skill set who can bring your vision to life. An expert organizer to help run and expand your movement efficiently. A ruthless military man who can enlist others to violently enforce your whims. A trusty assistant to maintain your busy schedule and record your pearls of wisdom for posterity. And a decorated hero to help you impress the deep-pocketed elites, because revolution isn't cheap. And of course, you always have to keep your eyes open for new talent. But as your movement grows, some might be tempted to challenge your authority. So never forget the one requirement that stands above all.
What you want is people who you can count on to be loyal.
And for that, Hitler could always count on this guy, who became his most loyal follower of all, Joseph Goebbels.
Goebbels adored Hitler. He heard Hitler speak at an event and became enamored and just said, okay, he is the one. Goebbels understood the power of modern media, of cinema, of controlling the media. And he understood the power of just hammering and repetition.
Joseph Goebbels became his propaganda chief.
Sure, talent is great, but what really matters is that your followers always put you first, even when things get really bad.
Goebbels was such a true believer. You know, at the end in a bunker in 1945, he and his wife poisoned their own 6 children. And then he poisoned himself because he could not imagine a world without Hitler.
If you've been following the Playbook's Guide to Seizing Power, you've identified your divine mission, tapped into your people's anger, crafted an everyman image, and branded an unforgettable identity for your movement. And now you have a loyal inner circle raring to go. But to take that final step to power, you still need an opening to take your shot. And when it does arrive, you better not miss. As pressure mounts to seize your moment, timing is everything.
You have to have a cobra-like patience before you pounce. The ability to play a long game, to wait.
Trust me, your patience will be rewarded. Let me show you. When Saddam Hussein was Iraq's vice president, he spent a decade building a secret service loyal to him before using it to help seize power from his boss. Joseph Stalin spent 7 long years cozying up to Lenin before the father of Russia finally put him in charge. Uganda's Idi Amin patiently stacked the army with members of his tribe, the Kakwa, who then helped him topple the president. Hitler almost blew his shot by ignoring this lesson and jumping the gun.
The beer hall push. Hitler mounts his kind of crazy half-baked coup, essentially tries to lead the mob of Nazis down the streets of Munich and trying to seize Bavarian political leaders, hold them hostage, force them to relinquish power. There's lots of miscommunication. They eventually leave the beer hall and then they're fired upon by the police. It's a huge error. Hitler gets sent to Landsberg prison. He's written off by the press all around the world. And there's this classic cutting, I think it's in the New York Times, which says it is expected that Herr Hitler will shortly retire from public life. He's there with one of his most loyal acolytes, Rudolf Hess. And it's Hess who convinced him to start getting down his kind of manifesto. And this manifesto, of course, becomes this book, Mein Kampf, My Struggle.
And yet, setting his goals to paper and getting released from jail after 9 months did not immediately turn around Hitler's fortunes. Things actually got worse.
The Roaring Twenties was a time of free expression and opportunities. The way people were dressing and their lifestyles, and women were more liberated. That was exciting.
Hardly. The last thing you want as an aspiring tyrant is a happy population.
The 20s were quiet years for Hitler. It was a political struggle.
But luckily, the good times don't last forever. In October 1929, the U.S. stock exchange crashes, and markets around the world follow suit.
Shortly after the Depression hit, that's when the Nazi Party took off.
Before the Great Depression, it was not a foregone conclusion that they were going to be the dominant party. July 32 was the peak moment of popularity of the Nazi Party at 37%. So Hitler actually is appointed chancellor.
Hitler's seizure of power, when he comes into office as chancellor, is not absolute. He's not head of state. There's still a president above him. He's got to start taking opportunities that are going to strengthen his grip on power.
Nothing says opportunity like a good crisis.
The Reichstag fire enabled him to pounce.
What could be worse than seeing the heart of your government burning to the ground? Yet when Hitler arrives on the scene, he seems less shocked than oddly inspired. "You're now witnessing the beginning of a new era in German history," he tells a reporter. He speeds to the offices of the Nazi Party's official newspaper and works until dawn. The next day, Hitler's headline blames communists for the Reichstag arson. Some have a different theory of what happened. They believe that it was actually Nazi operatives answering to Hitler himself who set the blaze in order to increase sympathies for their cause. Ignoring the whispers, Hitler demands government ministers sign an emergency decree he's cooked up, turning Germany into a police state under Nazi control, then takes it to President Paul von Hindenburg. Von Hindenburg is no match for Hitler's will or the swirling national crisis. The official decree gives Hitler sweeping power to imprison opponents, dissolve every political party but the Nazis, and muzzles the press.
Hitler was looking for an opportunity to end civil liberties and crush the opposition, and he found it. Potential dictators instinctively know that when people are threatened, they look for strong authoritarian leadership and support a strong man.
The stage is set. And Now it's only a matter of time. 17 months later, von Hindenburg dies, and Adolf Hitler becomes both Chancellor and President of Germany. Just 16 years after realizing his destiny in the trenches of World War I, and he's just getting started. To those who have made it this far, congratulations. You've built a movement and seized the reins of power. But now for the bad news. You're not the underdog anymore. You're the man, and that means there's a giant target on your back. So, how do you consolidate power and keep your rivals in check? As you continue your tyrant's journey, let Saddam Hussein answer the question on the minds of every new and vulnerable tyrant. How do you keep the wolves at bay? From day one of your reign, you'll be beset by enemies and treacherous rivals eager to bring your regime to a quick and likely violent end. It's a lesson one of history's most famous leaders learned the hard way, killed by former allies less than 2 years after naming himself dictator for life. Is that too ancient for you? How about Laurent Kabila of Congo, assassinated by one of his own child soldiers who got out of line? And then there's Liberia's Samuel Doe, captured and tortured on camera before being murdered by a rival warlord. But you can avoid their fate by using the playbook to put potential rivals in their place. And nobody did this better than the butcher of Baghdad, Saddam Hussein, who ruled Iraq for 24 years. By never forgetting the mantra all tyrants must follow, kill or be killed.
Saddam Hussein was a brute. His way to stay in power was to make sure that anybody he even vaguely suspected might be an opponent would be dead.
But before we get into how Saddam masterfully used the playbook to stay one step ahead of his rivals, here are some fast facts about how he made it to the top.
From a very early age, Saddam Hussein believed in power.
When he was young, Saddam would carry a metal rod, and he used this metal rod as a way to threaten and intimidate others, but he also used it to torture small animals.
And Saddam participated in the assassination attempt in 1959 of the leader in Iraq, Abdel Karim Qasim. And that really gave him a badge of honor within the Ba'ath Party. After the coup, one of his cousins, Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr, becomes the president, and Saddam was appointed vice president.
But Saddam was destined for bigger things.
Saddam was a vice president for 10 years, but in the meantime, he's actually taking alliances and creating friendships with different aspects of the government.
Saddam went one day to Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr and told him, "You're getting older. I hear your health is not in great shape. Time for you to retire."
Or to put it another way,
you have a choice of either be executed or have a peaceful transition of power. The next day, Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr goes on TV and says, "I'm retiring."
So now you know how Saddam rose to power. Let's talk about how he kept it. Starting with the first crucial period of any tyrant's reign, when you'll have to show what it means that there's a new sheriff in town.
There's certain rhythms to dictatorships. Right after they seize power is actually a very unstable time.
In order to stay in power, you have to be ever vigilant. You have to make sure that anybody who is a potential rival is controlled and put in their place.
And those will even include some of your first and closest allies with dangerous ambitions of their own.
Even a minor slight, if not dealt with, may be a signal to rivals that, oh, this guy is vulnerable.
These fair-weather friends are now waiting in the wings to try to take you down, so don't give them the chance.
Every general on the Great March with Mao was dead within a few years. Almost everybody who fought the revolution in Cuba on behalf of Fidel Castro was dead within 2 years.
How about Joseph Stalin's original comrades in the USSR?
All gone in a short time.
But Saddam did them one better with a surprise move for the ages.
One of Saddam's friends tells him that there are people who are murmuring and not happy about Saddam's takeover from al-Bakr. So then Saddam does this call for everyone in the Ba'athist party to attend Congress. And Saddam comes with his famous cigar. And he says, there are people in this room who are opposing my leadership.
And then a man by the name of Mashadi, the senior member of the Ba'ath Party, somebody who was highly regarded, begins to give a rehearsed speech. And in it, Mashadi confesses to having plotted a coup, a conspiracy against the Iraqi leadership, including Saddam Hussein.
Which, in truth, was entirely made up.
We know through accounts that Mashadi had been tortured. Saddam brought Mashadi's wife and daughters to the prison. And he told Mashadi he had a choice. He could either sit there and watch the guards rape his wife and his daughters and then kill them, or he would confess.
Mashadi chose option two.
And one by one, Mashadi begins to read out the names of Ba'athist officials who were, according to him, accomplices and conspirators. And then a member of the police dressed in plain clothes, the security force, would come and escort out this person.
Some of these men are begging him, like, please, no, no.
And it was a bizarre spectacle of feigned loyalty, but also fear. You could see the fear in the eyes of many of these men who felt at any moment their names could be arbitrarily read.
Outside the meeting room, the purged party members learn their fate. More than 20 are sentenced to die. The rest get prison time. They think they're lucky. Until they're forced to conduct the executions themselves. A sadistic twist, perhaps. But it extinguishes any doubt about what Iraq's new leader is willing to do to protect his authority. And in case anybody didn't get the memo,
the video of that meeting is sent all around, including to Iraqi embassies abroad. And the message was, look what happens when people are betraying the regime and their leader. That's the way they're going to end.
What better way to kick off a new era? But now that your rivals know what you're capable of, they'll have no choice but to raise their game as well. How do you make sure you keep the upper hand? To survive as a tyrant, you need to have eyes, ears, and muscle you can rely on everywhere.
For a dictator to keep any threats to his power from rising up, the only way to do that effectively is to do it in the shadows.
That's why every dictator's best friend is an effective and ruthless secret police. During the Great Terror of the late 1930s, Joseph Stalin's secret police, the NKVD, presided over the arrest and execution of nearly a million so-called enemies of the people, accused of opposing Stalin and his regime. In Uganda, Idi Amin enforced loyalty through his State Research Bureau, which was staffed by members of his tribe, as well as local criminals and mercenaries from abroad. Haitian dictator Papadoc Duvalier's enforcers were nicknamed the Tonton Macoute, or Boogeyman, after a character in folklore who kidnaps and eats unruly children.
The idea of a secret police in Iraq began in 1964 with the Jihaz Hanin, which was a security apparatus that Saddam helped found. After Saddam ascends to the presidency, he creates a special secret police, a subunit. It's comprised entirely of members of the tribe and family that are bound by blood and oath loyalty to Saddam Hussein.
In Iraq in the 1970s, everyone knew these people. They drove the same kind of cars. They dressed kind of the same. They even had the same mustache.
So much for the secret part. But no matter how much you empower your secret police, you'll need something else to show your rivals that there's nowhere to hide. A trusty network of informants.
In Saddam's Iraq, spying was everywhere. Everyone spied on the other. The Ba'athists are everywhere spying on you. So in my own family, for example, the only way my parents would speak is in the middle of the garden, blast out the radio far away from them, and then they would whisper to each other. And that's how they start talking with each other in the 80s.
Now, when the playbook says be everywhere, it's not just talking about inside your borders.
When dissidents would make their way into other parts of the world, Saddam would not hesitate to demonstrate that they were reachable to him, regardless of where they were.
Which leads us to Iraq's former Prime Minister Abdul Razak al-Naif. Al-Naif was a progressive politician and Saddam's longtime nemesis. But after Saddam and the Ba'athists seized power, al-Naif was forced to flee with his family. He moved to Great Britain and started speaking out, publicly criticizing the government. Unamused, Saddam begins exploring options for how to silence his worst critic. A pair of friendly neighborhood assassins pay al-Naif a visit. But they hit al-Naif's wife instead. She survived, by the way, and the gunmen were ultimately arrested. So now Saddam sends elite agents from his secret police from Iraq to London, where these skilled professionals tap their informants to keep track of al-Naif's every move, waiting for the opportunity to strike. This time, they don't miss. The assassination leaves behind a chilling message for Saddam's critics. No matter where you run, Saddam will find you. Murder and mayhem are always a solid play. But Saddam didn't rule by fear alone, and neither should you. For the next tactic in the playbook, you'll see how to appeal to another of your rival's soft spots, their greed. Whoever said you can't buy affection probably didn't try hard enough.
What an inner circle needs to stay loyal is actually very simple. They need to get more from the leader than they believe they can get from anybody else. The efficient way to stay in power is essentially giving the coalition bribes and opportunities to be corrupt.
Sounds pricey. So where's the money coming from?
Most of these regimes are highly sophisticated operations of kleptocracy.
What is kleptocracy exactly? Kleptocracy involves stealing the resources of your entire nation. Step one, nationalize your natural resources. Oil, gold, natural gas. If it's valuable, it needs to be controlled by the state, aka you. Step two, put your people in charge. You never play a big game without paying off the referee. So don't start despoiling your country without making sure all decision makers are on your team first. Step three, control all trade. Set artificially high prices. Hold back goods to create demand. Tack on some exorbitant taxes. Then watch the cash flow in. By mastering this technique, Saddam Hussein, once a penniless shepherd's son, got his net worth up to a cool $2 billion. But as tempting as it might be to keep the riches to yourself, a smart tyrant knows the value of sharing.
Saddam was able to plunder the resources, the oil wealth of the state, but he used these proceeds to not just enrich himself, but also as a form of patronage. He bought the loyalty of other senior party officials.
All this generosity isn't cheap, but ignore this tactic at your peril.
Some tyrants find that they have wasted so much of the government's money, so much of the people's money, that they don't have enough left over to take care of their inner circle. They wind up dead very quickly.
And if you're smart, you'll also set aside a little extra to share with the common people.
One famous Saddam would do, he would surprise Iraqis by visiting someone's home. And the first thing he would do is open their refrigerator. He had this image of himself that he is the man who would bring all Iraqis food. And when he sees empty refrigerator, he makes sure that he shows that there are people being loaded with gifts. So that's the charm, but it's mingled with the fear.
The end goal is to make people in the public say that no, actually everything is A-okay. This dictator is a good man. He's doing the right things, right policies. I like him.
Who doesn't want to be liked? But don't go soft now. Once your inner circle gets a piece of the action, they're going to keep demanding more. Time to develop a new skill. To remind them you're still the boss, and they're not.
Most successful dictators engage in ritual humiliation of everyone around them, including their closest collaborators, and they do this very early on so that the rules of the game are understood.
And why are these displays such a key part of the tyrant's playbook?
Because they're pathological narcissists. The tyrants are deeply insecure. Their response to any sort of criticism is attack.
You don't want somebody thinking that I have a better way to do things. Ideas are very bad for dictators.
Keeping your rival scared and off balance is so much better.
Saddam told friends how he killed one of his best friends who was a minister. His wife went to Saddam and said, please release meets him and he said, tomorrow you will find him at your home. The next day, Saddam sends his body cut in pieces in a coffin to his wife.
Stories like this were a form of control. Whether or not they were true was not the point. The point was to demonstrate that he could do these things. The potential was there.
Let me tell you a story. One day in the early 80s, Saddam orders a group of top ministers to report for a trip to destination unknown. They load onto a bus with blacked out windows that slowly drives them in circles around Baghdad. They arrive at a remote palace outside of the city. The men are directed to put all belongings into envelopes marked with their names. They're made to wash with disinfectant, then forced to wait in silence for hours. For you to understand this, you have to know what was happening at the time.
In 1979, under Ayatollah Khomeini, you had the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which Saddam looked at with great concern. So there was now this new Iranian regime that was calling for a rebellion, an uprising, an overthrow of Saddam, and actually had the resources to make it happen. Saddam decided to preemptively attack Iran.
He really believes that it is going to be a short war. Thought within a month, the regime will collapse.
Saddam Hussein's war against Iran has now lasted not 3 days, but 10 long months.
There was a lot of rumblings among some ministers. This is a dead end. Where is it going to end?
So before his restless allies got any bad ideas, Saddam decided to give them a little attitude adjustment. Let's get back to the palace where Saddam's ministers have been waiting in silent terror for hours. Finally, Saddam arrives. He speaks for 30 rambling minutes. Having seen their leader's brutality firsthand, the men prepare for the worst. Instead, Saddam invites them to a lavish supper, gives them $1,000 each, and has them driven home. But the message is clear. Next time, they might not be so lucky.
It was his way of instilling fear, of projecting his power and authority. It was a form of psychological manipulation.
What he was doing is keeping fear alive. And he did it with intention.
When times get tough, sometimes fear is all you have.
The Iran-Iraq war lasted 8 years. He lost a lot of soldiers. And at the end, Khomeini was far more popular and stronger in the whole world.
How frustrating. When your ill-fated plans lead to national disaster, you can count on facing even graver threats to your rule. Some from the most unexpected places. Time to show how far you're willing to go to preserve your power. Surviving as a tyrant means making tough decisions, and you can't allow your emotions to get in the way, even when it comes to blood.
Saddam had zero tolerance for any hint of rebellion or betrayal from members of his own family. He would not hesitate to arrest them, detain them, execute them, torture them, whatever he needed to do.
Is it too much to ask for your family to stick by your side no matter what? Of course not. After being crushed by coalition forces in the first Gulf War, Saddam needs to quickly reaffirm his authority, even if that means taking on his nearest and dearest.
Saddam's two daughters were married to Hossein Kamel and his brother Saddam Kamel. They were all third cousins, second cousins.
Saddam placed the older brother, Hossein Kamel, in charge of Iraq's nuclear weapons program.
Saddam really was almost besotted with him. Saddam thought that this is a great young man who might be even one day my successor.
Which came as unwelcome news to Saddam's eldest son and notorious psychopath, Uday.
Uday was truly cruel and sadistic. He was jealous of Hossein Kamel. Hossein Kamel is beginning to sense that Uday is going to make it more and more difficult for him. You know, sooner or later, kill him.
So one night under the cover of darkness, the brothers flee to Jordan with their wives and children. Hearing the news, Saddam is less than pleased, especially when he learns Hussein Kamel is demanding asylum and talking to CIA agents about Iraq's chemical weapons program. But Saddam knows just how to respond. He calls his daughters and swears the Kamals will be forgiven if they return home. He must have been pretty convincing since they all returned to Baghdad. But Saddam greets them with something other than open arms. He forces his daughters to divorce the Kamals. A few days later, Saddam's government claims the brothers are killed in a shootout with vengeful relatives at the family estate. But others tell a different tale. That Saddam sent a death squad led by his own sons, Uday and Qusay, to take the Kamal brothers out. What did you expect? Actions have consequences. The aftermath is even more dramatic.
They take the dead bodies and attach them to a car and drive the car dragging the dead bodies of Saddam's son-in-laws into the entire city. He horrified the entire country that this is what I can do to my sons-in-laws if they disobey me.
Cold-hearted? Sure. That's how Saddam kept his rivals underfoot. Until the last days of his reign. Nothing lasts forever. But to survive nearly this long, you're going to need to deal with threats even more challenging than treacherous rivals. Because they're coming from inside your population. Fear not. The playbook has some handy tricks to keep any restless citizens under control. But they're not pretty. Next up, Uganda. To meet the man who mastered the art of terror to preserve his reign. Are you ready to follow his lead?
See, you can see some of this stuff happening in this country by certain people. Now, I can't blame Biden because he's dimwit. He's just nothing more than a little hand puppet. That's all he is. All right, so much for now. This is the Armchair Survivalist signing off. Keep your nose in the air and the ear to the ground, and I'll see you next week.